big grace that that person got canceled. Right. Power is also the temptation. If that temptation is putting a person where they crush people, where they oppress people, we should take those leaders out of the position where they can do that.
Greetings and welcome to the Unleash Generosity Podcast, exploring the intersection of faith, service, philanthropy, and community. I'm your host, Aaron Scott. You can listen to all past episodes of the Unleash Generosity Podcast on our website, unleashgenerosity.org, as well as on any of your favorite podcast streaming platforms. We invite you to connect with us online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. All right, friends, we're going to jump right in. As I've said on previous episodes of this second season, we're weighing into some very difficult topics facing the nonprofit sector, facing faith communities, and facing us in society at large. Today's topic is heavy stuff. So up front, it's important to share a mature content warning. In today's conversation, we're going to discuss sexual, emotional, and spiritual abuse in religious organizations. I believe it's important to undertake this conversation, even though it's going to be quite uncomfortable. As always, I will try to approach the conversation respectfully. I recognize that this topic could be very triggering for some individuals, unfortunately, for too many individuals. So for those who might be listening, if this applies to you, please feel free to take your time and come back to this conversation when you're ready. Those listening with children, please be aware of the content. Trauma, abuse, and violence in faith communities is a challenging topic because all of us feel like our spiritual communities should be safe spaces where we can find relief from the hard things in life, and it should be healthy and welcoming spaces to process trauma and grief. But unfortunately, week after week, we see headlines of leaders of faith communities or religious organizations admitting to inappropriate behavior or being ousted from their role because they abused their power. It's been 20 years ago that many were first exposed to such abuse when the criminal charges were brought against Catholic priests in Boston, Massachusetts. It seems that today we're only uncovering more and more unhealthy situations of powerful religious leaders abusing those under their watch, and organizations both failing to prevent abuse and in many cases not even being willing to acknowledge that it happened in the first place. For people of faith, regardless of our spiritual tradition or our beliefs, we must wrestle with what it means when our group has been the source of such trauma. What does justice look like in such situations? What responsibility do we have to ensure that these abuses don't happen again? How do we protect potential future victims and make sure that they don't become just that? What should accountability entail for perpetrators? And what does grace and forgiveness look like in the midst of such harm? As a Protestant who was brought up in an evangelical church environment, I wanted to look at this issue through the lens of American evangelicalism. And there's no better person to talk about this topic with than my guest, Daniel Silliman. Before I introduce Daniel and we jump into the conversation, I want to thank Daniel for his honesty and sharing about some of his own toxic experiences growing up in the church. And that's the thing about this conversation. We don't just talk about trauma. We also talk about the goodness and the beauty that we find in our faith. Daniel talks about how his faith is an important part of his ability to do the hard truth-telling that he does as a journalist. And we laugh together and talk about the joy of teaching kids in Sunday school classes. And we discuss important questions like which are better, cats or dogs. In that sense, this conversation is sort of like life. It's not all good and it's not all bad. And I hope, like Daniel and I, you can find some hope in the midst of the darkness. All right, one final disclaimer. I currently work for Salvation Army, one of America's largest faith-based nonprofits. But nothing I say on this podcast is meant to speak on behalf of my employer. While I always strive to conduct myself in a way that my employer, my family, anyone who knows me would be proud of, by trying to be humble, gracious, loving, let me just be clear that I do not speak on behalf of Salvation Army. Any views shared on this podcast are always my own. All right, let's buckle up. Here's my conversation with Christianity Today's Daniel Silliman. My guest today is Daniel Silliman. Daniel is the news editor of Christianity Today. He is the author of a recently released book, Reading Evangelicals, How Christian Fiction Shaped a Culture and a Faith, published by Erdmans. Dr. Silliman is a trained historian, receiving his MA from Tübingen University and his doctoral degree from Heidelberg University, both in Germany, where he and his wife did campus ministry work in Germany, right?
Well, she did. I was getting the degrees.
You were working hard on the degrees. Got it. Daniel's insight and analysis has also been featured in multiple episodes of a podcast you've probably heard of if you're listening to this podcast, and that would be The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, Christianity Today's podcast, which is one of the most listened to religion and spirituality podcasts since it was released in the summer of 2021. Daniel also spent about 4 months doing some investigative journalism, which led to the first report of sexual and emotional abuse by Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias. And Daniel's continued to report on the Ravi Zacharias abuse story for Christianity Today, including articles about how Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, or RZIM, has handled those allegations and created a culture lacking in accountability and integrity. So Daniel's also a faculty member here at my alma mater, Milligan University, and where my wife teaches. And we go to church together, and we're actually gathered for the first in-person podcast that I've done. And we're sitting in Hopwood Christian Church in a Sunday school classroom. So I'm excited to actually like just get to look across a few feet and just have a conversation.
In Hopwood's renowned podcast studios.
That's right.
Behind the baptistry.
That's right, yeah. So I hope that you'll find this conversation to be a helpful discussion about, based on that introduction, those are some of the things we're going to talk about, or some of the things going on in American evangelicalism right now, in Christian nonprofits. So some of that will be kind of heavy, but I thought we might start with just some things to get to know you a little bit better and might be a little bit more lighthearted, set the tone a little bit. So, and I didn't tell Daniel about these questions ahead of time, so you have no idea what I'm going to ask you, and feel free to be as reflective and thoughtful or as evasive and dismissive as you'd like. So
I always do.
Okay, good. So the latter. Expect the latter, listeners. All right, so you are a cat person, right?
Yeah.
Tell us why cats are better than dogs.
Oh, man, dogs need so much. They're so needy. I personally can't handle the constant emotional demands of a dog. I like dogs. I have nothing.
Right.
But living with them, I find pretty exhausting. Cats are great. They are there. They definitely have like a relationship with you, a feeling for you. Our cat patrols the house to make sure we're safe.
Wow.
From ghosts, maybe, or from drafts. Like, I don't know what it is she's protecting us from, but she definitely has a strong sense of, but also they leave you alone.
Yeah.
They go do their own thing.
So dogs are like a good, I'll come over to your house and like pet your dog and play with your dog, but I don't want one of those around my
Absolutely.
House.
Yeah. I also work at home, so like I'm around my animal all the time.
Yeah, that'd be a bit much, maybe the dog constantly interrupting meetings, interviews, whatever. Next question, also related to cats. Just these two. is it true that you find cats are actually better than people?
You did someone tell you that I said that?
No, I just thought it'd be a funny follow-up.
Yeah, no, so, I mean, I don't want to say that generally.
You hate all people, don't you?
I have been in social situations where I have thought I could be with my cat right now. Right. I don't know if this is better than hanging out with my cat. Not quite want to say it as universally as all cats are.
Well, that's what I was trying to do. I'm going to do that with a number of questions in the interview, too. Just try to paint you into a corner and then watch you try to squirm out of it.
Get out.
Okay, good.
I think cats are great. I think my cat's the best.
What's your cat's name?
A lot of people are terrible. My cat's named Heidegger, after the German philosopher.
Nice. All right, third question, not cat-related. What do you find to be more relaxing, teaching my son Oliver's Sunday school class or beekeeping?
Oh, man, those are very different activities. they're both great. I don't know that either of them are relaxing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any favorite things that have happened in Sunday school, like questions that have come up or like just conversations you've overheard?
It's third to fifth grade, as you know. They're kind of crazy.
Sure.
But in ways that become really interesting. Last class I taught, we always read together the scripture for that Sunday, the New Testament scripture.
Yeah.
Last Sunday, the assigned reading ended at the Begats. Mm-hmm. And they decided they wanted to read the Begats, so we went through all of them.
Okay.
They pronounced all of the names.
Nice.
And we had long conversations about how some of the names were weird, and some of the names came up multiple times. And they just, I can't tell you how many times I've been in church where someone's like, the Begats are really hard to get through.
No. Not for this group.
The fourth grade boys were super into them, wanted to know everything about them. We're like, I'm so glad the Bible is full of Begats.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always fascinating to ask those questions, read those texts, and see what prompts their questions.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm almost like, we got to read it all.
Oh, Oliver said that?
Well, he was one of them.
I didn't get that report at home. So. All right, thanks for sharing that story. All right, last one. Again, I'm going to try to paint you in a corner here. So, as you mentioned in the intro, your wife led campus ministry. So your wife is an ordained pastor, ordained here.
She's ordained
from our
Hopwood. Yep.
Ordained by this congregation. You also like to drink beer. So how can you, in good conscience, actually call yourself an evangelical?
Oh, man. Because evangelicals don't drink beer.
Well, yeah. Wow. At least when I was like 8, that's what I thought.
Right? Yeah. It's not that hard, actually. It's pretty easy. You just did it.
Got it. Good answer. Yeah. All right. As we get started, and we'll talk a little bit about, some of these tensions and, like, who are evangelicals.
A lot of people are wrestling with from a lot of different directions.
Yeah. And you have, obviously, unique training and expertise to talk about that. But I thought, tell us a little bit about your faith background specifically, because I think that it's unique, but that it also, all of our backgrounds kind of factor into how we see the world, how we, our own experiences. But can you tell us about what, your faith was like growing up and the communities you were a part of?
Yeah, that could be this whole podcast, so I will try and keep it short.
Sure.
So my dad was a drug dealer converted by a street preacher.
Wow.
In the hippie days in the 1970s in Berkeley, California. He then became part of the sort of the Jesus People movement, and specifically like the Pentecostal movement of former hippies who'd become Christians and were now speaking in tongues, a lot of witnessing to people, and a lot of waiting, sort of as a culture the Jesus People were really waiting for the rapture. Jesus could come back today. If not today, it's tomorrow. There's a lot of living on the cusp. So it was my childhood. I was born on a Jesus People commune where everyone was waiting for the rapture. It fell apart pretty dramatically. A few years later, my parents moved to, when I was 9, my parents moved to a back to land commune in Texas. Which is a little different. Also, I had some similar threads. Also Pentecostal, leaned more holiness Pentecostal, if people are familiar with that. And we also, it was back to the land, so we farmed with horses. We made our own clothes, we made our own soap, and we waited for the Antichrist to come and kill us all. So that was my middle school faith experience was with them. We got kicked out of that group when I was 15, moved back to California, and ended up in a pretty radical homeschool group. And then that group got caught up in Y2K. So I was born in 1982, so I turned 18 in the year 2000. And Y2K did not happen, not to spoiler alert for the listener, but Y2K did not materialize. But that was my third, when I turned 18, that was my third apocalypse that didn't happen.
Yeah. I'll give you 3 strikes and now I'm out.
Yeah. And it was a moment of like, I couldn't have articulated at this time, but I think I realized that many of the adults that I had grown up with, could only live life if they were in that emergency state of preparing for the end. They're really good at being in emergency mode, in disaster mode, in preparedness mode. But how do you just live?
Yeah.
How do you live a faithful life where it's not that special, and you just have to be faithful in the mundane things. You just have to, like, love your neighbor every day and pay your bills every day.
Yeah, what does that look like?
So I think I realized at 18 that I was going to need to figure some of those things out. The shorter version that I tell people, I sometimes tell people I grew up crazy Pentecostal, and they say, is that the denomination? I'm like, kind of? Yeah.
Yeah. Out of that, I mean, so you're in multiple parts of the country, you're in multiple...
Yeah.
What I think is, you know, fair to characterize as, like, sort of radical versions of Christianity, not mainstream.
Radical was the word that was most often self-applied. Yeah. Almost all of the groups that we were in were trying in one way or another to be radical Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and I mean, one could argue that that should be a central tenet of the gospel, or what it means to follow Jesus. So, I didn't mean to imply that's negative, but at the same time, too, there can be some really challenging aspects of that, especially if some of the culture of some of those places has some unhealthy or toxic components. I mean, did you find that, how did your own, like, personal kind of foundation of faith, did it grow out of that upbringing, or was it something different than that upbringing?
It did. I mean, so much of being an adult for me has been finding ways to value what I got out of those experiences and what that made me, mm-hmm. without necessarily saying it's okay that happens to me. That's a kind of trick that I feel like I'm still figuring out. Mm. So on the one hand, I think I found a faith in those experiences that has lasted into adulthood. I found a durable faith in the midst of some situations that were violence and abusive and traumatic. Not trying to over-dramatize, but I think those words are fair. Mm. But I also, in college and after, had to take a bunch of things apart and put them back together again. You know, I spent a lot of time in church's hospital trying to figure out, you know, well, what does prayer look like if it's not like that? Or what part of my relationship to the Bible do I think is good? How do I... hang on to these pieces or discover the pieces.
Which is really, I mean, you said, you know, I had to kind of take pieces and parts apart. Buzzword right now is deconstruction. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, that are...
I studied philosophy in undergrad, and one of the things I did is write about Derrida, who his big idea was deconstruction, but an older, different idea.
Right.
So I have a lot of problems with
that term,
the contemporary use of the word. I'm still in the sort of postmodern Jacques Derrida use of the word. But I do think there's a sense in which all theology is deconstruction, and becoming an adult, growing up in the faith and becoming an adult, has to involve taking some stuff apart and putting it back together again. Hopefully putting it back together again in a way that works for you. Yeah, and that's a long process.
Yeah, that's part of what you have been able to do. I mean, you still identify as a Christian.
Yeah.
And again, even an evangelical Christian, which maybe we'll talk more about that a little bit. But
with Christianity, when I took things apart, I found that I still believed in Jesus. This will come up later when we talk about the Ravi Zacharias and investigating abuse and stuff.
Yeah.
In a way, I came to faith in Jesus while already knowing about a world where abuse happens, already living in a world where the truth of the universe, as I understood it, involved religious leaders being corrupt.
Yeah.
And then I met Jesus. I found, to quote the book of Job, that I know that my Redeemer lives. I mean, reading Job, specifically with a book by René Girard, turned out to be really helpful for me, because it's this idea of, like, he is someone who horrible things happen to, right? Trauma happens to him. Oppression happens to him. You know, this sort of violent universe happens to him. And then all these people show up, his friends in the book, to theologize why it's his fault and why he has to sort of accept the blame and never, never blame the world, or never, never just say, no, that was wrong, what happened to me.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, people show up and say, his wife in particular, and say, why don't you curse God? And he's like, well, I'm not going to do that either. I know that my Redeemer lives. I know that there is a good God. I know that there is justice, even if I can't explain it.
Yeah.
And then another way I thought about this more recently is the just the problem of evil.
Yeah.
That the Christian answer to the problem of evil is Christ on the cross. And I think that was the core sense for me, that having bad things happen to me, seeing people be corrupt, seeing churches be terrible places, didn't shake that for me. God exists and chooses to be on the side of the oppressed, chooses to be on the side of the abused, and that we're called to join that side as well, to take that side as well.
Yeah, that we participate in that redemption in some way. Let's shift a little bit towards your book, which connects with some of this. I mean, because again, evangelicalism in America right now, you know, has these sort of tensions in within the camp, however you define the camp, which is something, I guess let's start there. I mean, in some ways, your book is trying to sort of define who evangelicals are, but not through the traditional, you know, what is it called, the quadra?
The Bevington quadrilateral.
Yeah, which is like, this is like a definition, right? We need to have a definition of who evangelicals are. They believe these four things generally. I mean, you are suggesting that might not be the most helpful way to define evangelicals. Well, tell us about what the central premise of the project was.
Yeah, so so people have tried to define this broad religious movement, evangelicalism, either through sort of an essential theological core or an essential political core. I think neither of those quite work. The evangelicalism does theology and has theology, but that definition just ends up being pretty ahistorical. So I tried to come up with a what I call an imagination and infrastructure definition. So how to think about evangelicalism as a conversation. The academic term is a discourse community. And the conversation then leads to an imagined community. We can think about how we're all connected because we're all in the same conversation. And there are real sites of conversation. There are real networks that organize that conversation, real structures in the world that bring that conversation together, and then produce this imagination where you can think about your faith, you can think about what it means to believe, and you can also think about how you're connected to other people. So I use bookstores and best-selling novels to tell a different story, a new story of 20th century evangelicalism that captures, I think, more of the multiplicity, more of the way that evangelicalism is always 17 and a half things at once. That's not an exact number. I just made that up.
That sounds about right, though.
Yeah, it's always a bunch of different things that are kind of hung together.
Yeah.
And some of them fit together really well, and some of them kind of don't. And people find their different ways to exist in that. So thinking about how they hang together can help us think about how it's a bunch of different things at once, and also how there's just a lot more contingency in evangelicalism. Like, as a movement, a lot of people have written about it and talked about it, both from within and without, as if it always is one thing and has to be another thing, and it had to lead a certain way. And my read of the history is it just is a lot more fluid than that. So I use bookstores and best-selling novels to tell that story. I don't think that's the only way to find infrastructure and imagination, but I thought it was a super interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, because if you would have just used the description you just said and like, well, there are these conversation spaces, you know, my mind immediately goes to, oh, well, that's like, you know, Christian universities and this is churches, obviously. But you chose bookstores, which again is, maybe wouldn't have made the top 10.
Sure.
You know, if you did the Family Feud and you asked everyone, which of the bookstores, Christian bookstores wouldn't have maybe made the list.
So to connect back to my personal story, I had a moment when we were kicked out of that group. I ended up spending a bunch of time in a Christian bookstore and trying to figure out what the rest of Christianity looked like.
Sure.
because I'd had such a constricted experience, the bookstore was a space to kind of see the landscape and figure out where I fit on that landscape. It also works really well for the kind of story that I want to tell, as opposed to, like, I don't know, churches or colleges, because it's so broad, because it pulls in a lot of lay people, it pulls in a lot of women, it pulls in a lot of men who don't have official positions in church, a lot of histories of the movement of evangelicalism kind of just say what the leaders were doing and what the leaders thought.
Yeah.
Bookstores actually are much more varied.
So what are the five books you looked at? I mean, we don't need to go in depth on all five of those.
Sure.
And the five, how they parallel with the five. People can go read your book. They should buy your book find that out.
Yeah.
That would be a good project for every listener to do. But what were the five books
you
chose?
Books. Yeah, and I talk about the books enough that if you haven't read them, you can follow along. You'll understand why the book is important.
I haven't read any of them, and I thought that was the case.
On the other hand, if you like, if one of these books, you're like, I wondered what was up with this book. I hope to explain it. So it starts in 1979. The first novel that I look at is Love Comes Softly by Jeanette Oak, who's a Canadian, and this is the first, like, it launches the genre of Christian romance.
Yeah.
Then 1986, Frank Peretti, This Present Darkness, which is demons and spiritual warfare, wildly popular. Then Left Behind, I really focus on the first one. And then The Shunning, which is by Beverly Lewis. If you go into a Barnes & Noble today, you will see a long aisle full of books with women in bonnets. That was started by Beverly Lewis. It's called Amish fiction or Amish romances. Sometimes bonnet rippers, more derogatively. And then The Shack is the last one by William Paul Young, which was is about a... Recently, the movie dropped on Netflix, so it jumped up into the top of the best-selling list again just like a week ago. But it came out in 2008. And it's a story of a man going to a shack in the woods and having an experience with the three persons of the Trinity and dealing with the problem of evil and suffering.
Cool. Well, we could go on and on talking about reading evangelicals. And I hope readers who or listeners who haven't read it will pick it up and check it out. Just because there's a lot more we could talk about with that, I'll include in the show notes two about hour-long conversations you had. One with Christian Cobet Dumais. Did I say that right?
I think so.
Thank you.
Dumais, for sure.
Dumais, thank you. I got at least part of it right. So she interviewed you for an Erdman's conversation.
Yeah.
So she enjoyed being the interviewer and not because she's been on, like, what, every Christian podcast there is? As well as a lot of mainstream podcasts because, again, the reach of Jesus and John Wayne is, again, in a helpful way, similar to your book, like helping us make sense of what's going on in American evangelicalism. So I'll link to that interview that you did together. And then also one you did with our mutual friend David Kiger for the Inglewood Review of Books. So so if you're interested in learning more about reading evangelicals and more about some of the cool stuff Daniel does in that book, you'll have 2 hours of more joyful listening to enjoy. But before we move away from the book, I want to ask you one pointed question, because I think this is, in many ways, if you're listening to media or just in dialogue with other people, like you said, that care about this stuff, it's like, this is, in my mind, what I think is the main question people are kind of asking right now. So they feel like something shifted, something significant happened in 2016, where they like thought evangelicalism was like one thing, but then all of a sudden Trump comes along and 81% or whatever it was of evangelicals, overwhelming majority number, vote for Trump. And there's tension in there because Trump is a complicated figure and he didn't embody what had previously been the conception of what, you know, American evangelicals should support. And yet overwhelmingly they support him. And so some people are like, wait, what's going on here? And other people are like, well, I mean, this just makes complete sense. So, I mean, this is what I think is the premise that a lot of people are operating under now. And I'm curious, as a historian, if you think this is too oversimplified or if this is pretty accurate. American evangelicalism is wholly and irreversibly intertwined with Christian nationalism. with right-wing politics and with the Republican Party. Is it that simple in your mind, or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, I think it's more complicated than that. I agree that white evangelicalism is intertwined.
Yeah.
The holy I want to push back on, mm-hmm. and the irreversibly I want to push back on. I mean, holy, even in the numbers that you talked about,
yeah.
it's 81% sure. of white evangelicals. 19% of white evangelicals is still one of the largest religious movements mm. in the United States. Like, we shouldn't dismiss that percentage. That's also the percentage of people who voted. So I don't think we have a good sense of how many people just didn't vote that election.
Sure.
Remembering that the other candidate was Hillary Clinton, who is beloved by all. No. who was a very particular candidate to vote against.
Sure.
And then irreversibly, that's just not my sense of how history works.
Yeah.
I think that's as a historian, I find declarations that things are irreversible just don't, that's not the world we live in. Stuff moves in all sorts of weird ways, and I think it could move again. It has moved in the past.
Yeah.
And it's one reason that I spend a lot of time trying to direct people back to contingencies.
Yeah.
There are a lot of forks in the road that got us here.
Yeah.
There will be more forks in the road in the future. At the same time, I also don't think it's right to say that 2016 was completely surprising. I think if it totally surprised you, you missed some important stuff, and you should probably do some work of listening to the people who weren't surprised at that time.
Yeah.
It's not, from a historical perspective, it's not irreversible, it's not holy, but it's also not surprising that we ended up here.
Yeah. And you can say those things and still say, like, that doesn't mean I think that it was a positive thing that 81% of evangelicals unquestioningly are behind Trump and churches are supporting him without any sort of critical pushback or, and that's what I think you were saying earlier about, like, in some ways it's too easy to define evangelicals as we believe these four things. It's 17 and a half things, and it's all more complicated than just this or that.
It's right? There's 17 and a half versions of evangelicalism. And, I mean, even with the, like, 81% that supported Trump, thinking that all of those 81% did it for exactly the same reasons and with exactly the same commitment and vigor, like, that's just not, I don't know, that's good for a Facebook post, but, like, that's not sufficiently nuanced to really understand. If your goal is to understand the world and not just say those people are bad and I'm not a part of them, then I think we have to do a little more work.
So you write for a Christian magazine.
Yeah. Normally described as the flagship magazine of American evangelicalism or something like that. Yeah,
right.
Very much.
And so, I mean, it's your job as a journalist to be unpacking and looking into stories that have to do with this group, this world. So the biggest, maybe, CT project that's gotten the most buzz is dipping their toe into the podcast world, in the rise and fall of Mars Hill. You appeared on a couple episodes just as a commentator, providing some historical analysis or journalistic analysis of what your sense.
I think I'm in two episodes as providing historical analysis, once on the history of megachurches, once on the history of evangelicals and demons. That turns out to be something I know more about than most people, which is probably because most people don't know that much.
That's pretty cool to be able to say
demonology, exorcism ministries, deliverance ministries. And then I show up in the first episode as the news editor to talk about why does CT cover bad stuff, I think is the
critical stuff.
Way.
Yeah.
Yeah, like there's a lot of religious magazines that are kind of promotional, essentially. And CT, we certainly are interested in good stories and profiling people who are great, But yeah. We also do some critical work and some investigative work and talk about bad parts of evangelicalism.
Yeah. It could be seen that the whole premise of the podcast was, let's choose a character, Mike Driscoll, let's talk about Mars Hill, because it can give us a platform to kind of throw stones at some of the problems with American evangelicalism. So I like that at the end of that first episode, you all are aware enough of that to say, like, why do we think it's important to have these kind of stories? And I'll just read you. And so Mike Cosper basically said, like, why do you think it's important for critical stories to be told? And you said, as a Christian and a journalist, I'm committed to the truth. And that has to come first and last. And when people ask that question, like, why are you saying critical things? They're maybe without meaning to, maybe even with the best of intentions, suggesting that their tribalism, their friendships, their associations, their acquaintances in the church should take a higher priority for me than just speaking the truth. And that feels like a terrible witness for a Christian to take. Like, I believe in the truth. As Christians who know the truth, the way, the truth, and the life. Oh, but I like this guy, so I'm willing to silence things and cover them up. That seems like a really damaging position for Christians to take, especially for people who've been hurt. And I feel like if we look away, it feels to the hurt people, to the silenced people, like we're taking a side of the people who said, well, God wants you to never talk about this. God is condemning you to silence. And that's the evil we're trying to fight by speaking the truth, by choosing to be on the side of the truth, even when it's painful to us personally. So that's a long quote, but I really was drawn to that because, as you know, like, I've worked in the nonprofit sector for the better part of a decade. I'm a fundraiser, so outward facing, you're in some ways responsible for not only bringing in money, but also like being the public face of organizations. And so this whole idea of silence and who has authority to speak and what you can and can't say so that you don't, you know, put a black eye on your organization. I think that's a real big tension right now in the Christian nonprofit world. I'm curious to ask specifically about covering things up, being silent, and that is a central component of what was going on with the Ravi Zacharias stuff.
Right.
Can you talk just about what it was like for the months that you, you know, investigated that story and just the process of getting to the point of publishing that?
Yeah. And your question about how to be the face of something, I mean, I think before I talk about Zacharias, like, I think it's worth speaking versus being silent can take a lot of different forms.
Sure.
So I wasn't intending with that answer to suggest that everyone should abandon all the jobs and all become journalists.
Right.
But I do think that people in those other jobs have a responsibility to speak up when something's wrong, have a responsibility to cultivate cultures of accountability, and there are a lot of ways to do that. For people to take responsibility and speak the truth. And one of the things that happened, we can get into this, but one of the things I saw happen at RZIM, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, was a lot of insiders taking responsibility, even responsibility that hadn't been given to them, but they just found themselves in the position where speaking up really mattered. Mm. And they did speak up when it mattered. And I actually had a very weird experience of, on the one hand, reporting about RZIM and having the sense of, like, what a terrible organization and it's so bad. And then also seeing all of these people sort of stand up, sometimes at great personal cost, even just in internal meetings to say, no, this has to be answered and, like, we can't just blow this off. But yeah, reporting that story. I first got a tip in August of 2020 that Ravi Zacharias, who passed away a few months before that, had secretly owned some spas in suburban Atlanta near the offices, the international offices for RZIM, and that he had sexually abused the female employees who worked at the spas that he co-owns. It took me a long time to investigate that.
Yeah.
Within a couple of weeks, I had evidence that he had owned the spas. That part of the story I actually established pretty quickly. And then I had some evidence that there had been abuse happening. But I ended up deciding that I wanted three people to tell me independently similar stories documenting it, that would be sort of adequate evidence to go public with these kinds of claims. And it took me a long time. I had to track down some women, including one who had changed her name, changed her profession, left town. And when I finally talked to her, she told me that she'd never told anyone about what had happened to her.
Wow.
And that she might hang up on me suddenly if her husband or kids came home, because she'd never told them about it and wasn't planning to. She'd made a complete clean break in her life. But she decided that telling the truth was worth it, and telling the truth, if it could help other people, if it could help other women, would be important. Yeah. So we came out with the first story on this in November. So RZIM ended up choosing to do a internal, or they hired a law firm to do an investigation. Mm. The investigation confirmed my reporting and found a bunch of other stuff as well.
Mm.
They had access to Zacharias's cell phones and found a bunch of stuff on his digital media, which obviously I didn't have access to. And that report came out about a year ago, actually, in February of 2021.
Putting in context, this isn't just...
He's not just a guy.
This isn't just some fringe nonprofit.
It's the largest apologetics ministry in the world, and one of the most famous Christian apologists.
And this is a large organization with hundreds of employees,
hundreds of employees, 16, 17 offices, I don't have the numbers in front of me, around the world, and a whole roster of speakers who would go to universities and other places and sort of make the argument that it's intellectually justified to be a Christian would be the primary thing. And Robbie Zacharias had been doing this since the 80s, written many books, had many radio programs, convinced many people that Christianity was reasonable. And, I mean, I think the specific irony of it was that he would argue that we should pursue the truth at all costs.
Yeah.
And he would argue that Christians shouldn't be afraid of questions, but should actually fearlessly engage the intellectual questions that were being asked, and not just say, have faith, but really wrestle with them and really invite people to ask questions.
And yet
at the same time, living a secret life, pushing a cover-up, sexually abusing, multiple women over a long period of time, telling them that if they didn't keep it secret, that the souls of everyone who he didn't do ministry to would be on their conscience, and condemning them to secrecy, which was kind of what I was thinking about when I was talking to Mike. The impact of the silence on people who've been abused.
And is either through your reporting or what's come out later, is there been conclusive evidence that it could have been known, or those in the organization did know and helped cover it up? Or is it just that there wasn't a culture of accountability to be able to ask maybe some hard questions that should have been able to be asked?
There are people who should have known.
Yeah.
Whether they did know, I don't have that evidence for.
Okay.
But there was a culture of looking the other way.
Yeah.
There was a culture of extending the leader such a benefit of a doubt that any questions were considered unreasonable. I mean, I found in 2008 there was an investigation. Someone reported that they had seen Ravi Zacharias holding hands with a woman outside a hotel in Hong Kong.
Hmm.
And the ministry did an investigation. The investigation amounted to, they asked him what the deal was. He gave an explanation. They dropped it.
And
there was other stuff that came up in 2016. People asked questions. They were told, how can you not trust him? You have to trust. They just dismissed and diminished and gaslit people until they stopped asking questions. But that's definitely a culture that doesn't believe in accountability. That's a culture that doesn't believe that sin affects famous people.
Yeah.
It's a culture that believes the celebrity of one man needs to be protected over and above the truth.
And clearly part of the challenge is that this isn't an isolated story in evangelicalism, right? I mean, because we've got your reporting, and then you've got, I mean, I was listening to the Gangster Capitalism podcast in the last year where they do a really good job kind of uncovering what's been going on at Liberty University and sexual assault of students and underreporting these cases on purpose to make their campus appear more safe. And we're not, you know, we're talking about Liberty students who were raped and then slut shamed and were expelled from school while the male perpetrators were kept because they were athletes or in just crazy stuff. So, I mean, you have all these different...
And just to add to that, because right now the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest Protestant church, is in the process of trying to do a review of 20 years of how sexual abuse allegations have been handled at their seminaries and at their colleges and at their institution. There have been major investigations also into the Independent Fundamentalist Baptist Church. I think it's probably the case that there's a church in every town where sexual abuse is happening, where ministers are being abusive. I've received enough personal reports and talked to enough people on stories that I can't report, either that there's not enough evidence or it doesn't quite work. You've never heard of this church. Why would I be reporting on this one little church? Yeah. It has to meet certain criteria for it to make sense for Christianity Today to do a big story on it. But I've heard enough and talked to enough people that I think it's not a crazy speculation that probably in every town there's one.
Yeah. And that's, you know, we're not trying to say this is a uniquely American evangelical problem, because obviously the Catholic Church has its own. Is it as simple?
Churches.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so is it as simple to just say, well, this isn't really anything new. Like, we're, you know, the powerful people are going to use their power and influence to try to get what they want and then try to silence people to so that they don't get held to account for it? Or do you think, I mean, it seems like there's a different sort of conversation right now where more people are like, just more aware, the Me Too movement, the Church Too movement, that it's like, oh, like we're aware to a deeper level. Is there something darker or more sinister going on than we realize?
So I mean, just to focus on the question of like, is this new or has this always been going on?
Yeah.
I mean, I think both of those can be problematic.
Yeah.
Sometimes when people say, oh, it's brand new, they seem to be suggesting that, like, if we could just roll back the clock and go back to the way it was. And that doesn't seem right. It seems like this was happening before. It seems to me that it's really hard to track the history of these things because they're secrets, right? Yeah. But it seems to me that the new thing is a push for justice. The new thing is an awareness. The new thing is people trying to get the truth out. At the same time, I'm always a little concerned when I say, like, no, this has always been happening, that people will respond by kind of throwing up their hands and say, well, then there's nothing you can do. Like, it's just a truth of the world. And I think, I don't know, maybe going back to Job, we should still object.
Right.
Even if it has always been the case that that people with power, religious people, have abused power and crushed individuals in the process. And that is as old as the history of power. It's still wrong. We can still fight it. And it seems that there's a new movement to kind of declare that and to say we don't have to just live with it anymore.
Yeah. And it's complicated, right? I mean, because you think about the story of somebody like David, who used his power to sexually have an inappropriate relationship with a person, had a husband killed, like just would David have just been canceled today? Yet, he scripture describes him as a man after God's own heart. He's a complicated character. And so, again, it's not, I don't want this conversation to come across either as like us and them. Like, we're the holy ones over here judging all the people who don't have all their crap together. I guess that's one of my big takeaways is that we're all, like, we all are in need of grace. But I think your point, too, about that there's a deeper sort of recognition that it's like, it's not enough just to say like, oh, we're all sinners, so we just need to ask for forgiveness and that's the end of it. But like, no, there's some sort of like deeper, it needs to begin with fully acknowledging like and repenting, we need grace.
Yeah.
Let's start there. And that too, that there's gotta be some level of accountability. Like, what does justice look like when we have wronged people? What do we need to do about that? And I think there's a deeper sense where people are saying, no, it's not enough just for people to resign or people to move. Like, there needs to be some accountability.
There does need to be some accountability. And I don't see any reason to think that everyone needs grace and everyone should hopefully find some way towards restoration. I don't see any reason that that needs to include still being in power.
Yeah.
So we can talk about like, oh, it's so this person got canceled. It might be grace that that person got canceled.
Right.
Power is also the temptation. If that temptation is putting a person where they crush people, where they oppress people, we should take those leaders out of the position where they can do that. I mean, we talk about David. I don't see any evidence in that story or in scripture that it was a good idea that one man could have another man killed because he attracted, like, he shouldn't have had that much power in the first place.
Yeah.
And the prophets told the people, you don't want a king.
Yeah.
This is a problem for someone to have this much power. I think it would have been grace to David if they had taken away the power to rape a woman and kill her husband. I don't see any reason to be sad about that being the outcome for David in that situation. Like, what's the loss? It's not bad for David. It's not bad for us. It's definitely not bad for Uriah.
And yet there's no authority to do that in American evangelicalism because it is this.
Well, nor was there in ancient Israel. He was the king. There was only a prophet who could stand up and say, you're the man.
And is that the grace in the story? Is that at least there was somebody calling him to account?
At least there was someone calling.
God sees what you did, and this was wrong.
Yeah.
And you...
I mean, I really regret the fact that Rabbi Zacharias died before I wrote the story. Like, I think it would have been better for him if he had been called out in the 1980s, if someone had taken his name off his own building. There's so many times he could have been called out, not to mention all the future
victims.
Another thing I want to say about the victims is that every one that I talked to in the Rabbi Zacharias story thought they were the only one.
Mm.
I think it's very part of what's changing now is people realizing that they're not quite alone.
Mm.
They thought they were alone. They often thought that they were so sinful that they had made this man do a bad thing. They took all the guilt on themselves. He's a famous Christian. He must be great. I must be so sexually perverted that I like caused this thing to happen.
Yeah.
And then, no, he's doing exactly the same thing over and over and over.
Yeah.
And that's another reason that telling the truth can be so important, right? It shifts the blame to where it actually belongs.
Yeah.
It helps us understand the truth of what happens. And it gives people a chance to repent. It gives people a chance to be, to own what they've done wrong and take responsibility. And I don't know, I don't think I'm hurting people when I expose them. I think it's grace that's long overdue that they then have to decide what to do with.
What is it like when you have these lots and lots of people from across the country that then read these stories and reach out to you to say, this has been my experience too. And it's not a story.
Yeah.
You can't cover all those stories.
That's
for
right.
the, like, I don't, maybe their goal is just to feel heard and to reach out to you to say, this is happening other places too. And here's my story. Maybe some of them are hoping that you're going to cover their story. What do you do with that? with all these people that reach out to you?
I mean, I try and be honest that there's only so much justice in this world, and writing about abuse and exposing abuse brings a little bit of justice, but not very much, yeah, actually. And I think people often hope it'll be the thing that suddenly ushers in,
sure,
justice or rights their wrongs, and you have to tell them, like, even if I can write a story, that's only a piece. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the Ravi Zacharias story, I talked to the three women that sort of were willing to go on the record with me. We had conversations where I said, like, it has to be enough just to tell the truth. I don't know that we're going to change anything. Yeah. I have no idea what's going to happen or what the fallout's going to be or whether the ministry is ever going to acknowledge the truth of what we're saying. But we have to be willing to do this just because it's worth telling the truth. When people call me...
It must be a very humbling thing to have people...
Yeah, you try and carry it. I mean, it's a pastoral thing.
Right.
But you offer to carry it for them.
Yeah.
You offer to talk to them. You offer to, you know, tell them how their experience compares to other people's experiences. That's often a useful thing to people. Sometimes there's recommendations. Sometimes you can tell people other things they can do besides get a story in Christianity Today. But a lot of times it's just talking to them and trying to be as honest as possible and listen.
How has it been for you? Like you said, I mean, you're almost like a counselor. You're almost like a pastor dealing with these people with their most traumatic thing in their life.
Yeah.
That's a lot for you just as an individual to carry.
Sure.
What have been the things that have been helpful for you to kind of been able to process that well in a healthy way? Or, like, I mean, you don't feel free to be as...
Yeah.
You don't have to be super vulnerable. I'm just curious. I imagine that's been really hard.
It is hard, but I also think that one of the reasons that I'm good at it and one of the reasons I might be called to it is that I don't seem to struggle as much as other people with it. I mean, when I was a newspaper reporter, I covered crime, and I had 100 murders in 2.5 years, so that was a different way of carrying a lot of this brokenness. But some of it goes back to my own experience of finding a Jesus and being found by Jesus who takes the side of the broken and the oppressed and the abused. So I take comfort. I return to that and take comfort in that it's okay. Like Job, if I can't fix it, I can just declare it wrong.
Yeah.
And can just declare that this is evil and not try and theologize it away and not trying to make the world okay, not try to defend the existing order of things, but just to say, Jesus says this is wrong. I think this is wrong. And the spiritual practices that help me return to that are the important ones, I would say, in dealing with it. Which is just prayer, church, teaching Sunday school to Oliver and his friends.
Thanks for sharing that. Because, that's hard. I mean, it's interesting, like you said, that whether it's your personality or your life experience, I mean, something that you maybe have been given, something that has equipped you to be able to try to do that well and not let it destroy you and tell these stories. And
I think so.
And that's maybe a gift. I'm sure it's not easy for you. But
another piece of that is, like, it's one of the special parts of doing it is feeling like you win people's trust.
Mm.
And having people trust me with their stories and their deeply painful stories, and sometimes stories that they feel overwhelming and incredible shame and haven't been able to talk to the people around them because they feel so much trauma, so much shame, and having them trust me with those, I seem to win trust in these situations pretty quickly in ways that has surprised me. I didn't necessarily know about myself. I think some of it is through practices of listening Though I also think that some of it is just having seen a lot of dark stuff and not quite being overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I had a friend who was a counselor once, and I started telling him some things, and he was just like, you could see on his face that he thought this was like the worst thing he'd ever heard.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, I can't, this person can't be my counselor. My experience can't be trauma to the counselor. Like, I need a counselor who's like, oh, yeah, I've heard this. Let's talk about like how to deal with it.
Yeah, I can and help I think, you process.
And I think I offer that sometimes to to people who've been abused or had these bad experiences, that I can just sort of absorb that into my understanding of the world. And the worst thing that happened to this person, I can help them feel a little normal. Maybe find some grace in their own life.
Well, thank you for that ministry that you do. And thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing about, you know, what's been going on in your career and your story. Again, I think very personal in some ways and vulnerable. So thank you. I want to thank Daniel again for being my guest, for his role as a leading reporter in covering the Rabbi Zacharias RZIM abuse case. I should note that after Daniel and I recorded this conversation, Christianity Today themselves did their own internal investigation about their own organization and a few situations of abuse. Daniel did his own independent investigation of his own employer and reported on his findings. I will link to that in the show notes, along with a variety of other resources that we referred to in our great conversation. So please check out unleashgenerosity.org for show notes and more on this topic. All right, in closing, please note that we have a new Patreon page where I invite you to support the show financially if you're able. This podcast is a passion of mine, and up to this point, all the costs for equipment and technology tools, as well as all the actual hours of audio editing, all that's just been done by me. Your support would not make me rich, but if you find these conversations meaningful, what some support would do would allow me to hopefully invest in some editing help with the goal of getting these episodes and conversations published more quickly and getting even more content out. And I'm excited to share that there will be some exciting bonus content only available on our Patreon page. There will be some community conversations that I will be hosting that only Patreon supporters will be able to participate in. And our first bonus episode contains another 30 minutes of conversation that Daniel Silliman and I had. So check out patreon.com/unleashgenerosity. And thanks for your support. I'm grateful, as always, for Daniel Cooper for doing the music and allowing me to share his wonderful gifts with you as a part of the podcast. All right, friends, as always, until next time, unleash your own generosity.